In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. On this show, we worked backward into the catalog of Kent Bain's books, beginning with Blackjack, then Most Dangerous, and ending with the most dangerous book in the world, 9/11 as Mass Ritual. Kent Bain was on the show in April of 2014 discussing his book, 9/11 as Mass Ritual. And it's appropriate to revisit the anatomy of the world's greatest mega ritual that set the tone for a new millennium 20 years ago. In the last two interviews with Kent Bain, we examined the psychological operations, psychodrama, revelation of the method, ritual mockery, and default public consent brought by inaction. Author Michael Hoffman's related statement, quote, "Consent fuels control like no other form of energy." It references when a populace, still in shock from the spectacular violence, finds it easier to pretend the official story isn't full of inconsistent detail and suspicious fact, often found throughout any major false flag event. Dr. Judy Wood brought the irrefutable scientific proof showing the World Trade Towers turned to dust in the air. Dr. Wood cites how the recorded seismic impact doesn't correlate with towers weighing 500,000 tons apiece slamming to the ground. From the occult perspective, that ground is known to be an altar, and the towers represent sacrificial vessels. They are also the pillars of Hermes, stationed at the gates of Solomon's Temple, or the Solomon Brothers Building, or Building 7. Kent Bain reveals to the reader how ritual magic connected the barbaric attacks through time and space with astrology, sacred geometry, gematria, and numerology. We look deeper into the brutal attacks of September 11, 2001, through the lens of an occult ritual. A ritual designed to malign society with a perpetual state of fear and permanent war, while justifying the total spectrum dominance with a technological machinery of tyranny constructed around it. Kent, welcome back to Another News.
Fantastic to be here.
Well, most researchers know about the unusually staged event at Emma E. Booker Elementary School taking place on the morning of September 11, 2001 in Sarasota, Florida, the location of which President George W. Bush happened to be sitting with second grade students as the teacher prompted them to loudly recite the children's story titled My Pet Goat. What most people didn't know and may not yet realize is this innocuous reading lesson was integral to the mega ritual attacks and loss of life occurring in real time. Would you please remind listeners about the ritual intent of this gathering in the classroom and the related artificially generated synchronicity?
This represented a nationally televised black mass filled with dark humor. The children in the classroom were chanting in unison, essentially as they read aloud the My Pet Goat. If you stand back and look at it with knowing eyes, you can recognize that it's just dripping with dark humor, that it is, in fact, a black mass that is helping to kick off the entire series of events that occurred on 9/11, the larger mega ritual, and as you pointed out, of course, as this black mass was occurring, people were literally dying in flames and jumping to their deaths at the World Trade Center. Of course, there was significance in the location of this black mass as well in Sarasota, Florida, which is where, just by coincidence, Muhammad Atta, one of the ringleaders of the 9/11 attacks, just happened to have taken flight lessons.
That's the artificial synchronicity, is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Would you tell listeners more about what this artificial synchronicity is and how it works?
The orchestrators of these types of false flags and 9/11 in particular, the cryptocracy, they seek to emulate genuine synchronicity in part to imitate the unseen powers, and then also on a serious level to invoke the blessings of the dark gods. And then on an entirely different level, sometimes these engineered synchronicities are amount to inside jokes. And one other aspect of the Sarasota connection is that the Barnum and Bailey Circus had a clown training program there. And those listeners familiar with Michael Hoffman's work will recognize that connection with railroad workers and circus clowns and circus performers. There's this thread that runs throughout these engineered staged events, and you frequently find references to clowns or clowns somehow incorporated into the events that are occurring. So that is a humorous aspect to it that you could miss, but it just adds from the perspective of those that orchestrated the entire series of events on September 11th, just added another level of meaning for them.
I've been to that museum. It's a beautiful building, beautiful place, and there is a Masonic connection, a Freemason connection to clowns, the Jester, and there is the secret group called the Order of the Jesters. Michael Hoffman writes, "Ritual murders are accomplished. Later we learn the truth, but no one is prosecuted. We are mocked, disoriented, and demoralized. Occult prestige and potency is heightened." Would you please talk about the paradox of the Hoffman lens and spreading the idea of the cryptocracy's immunity and invincibility?
By exposing the inner workings of these rituals and examining them and explaining how things were done, why they were done, by doing an autopsy on these events, we're in essence doing the cryptocracy's work for them. We're exposing how they pulled off their staged event, and in many instances, as Michael Hoffman observes, this is exactly what the orchestrators intend, and they design the events so that the details will come to light years after the event itself takes place, but then no one is ever held accountable, which enhances their aura of invincibility and speaks to their almost omnipotence.
You could make a list of the various events, false flag events that have occurred, and really no one was held accountable. Maybe Donald Rumsfeld can't visit certain countries because he could be arrested. 20 years ago, a lot of the black mass rituals were hidden in plain sight, and there seemed to be more of an attempt to conceal ritually charged symbols, language, and events. And would you talk about how the rituals, such as those appearing as entertainment during halftime spectacles in arena sports, for example, are now conducted out in the open?
That's exactly right. There really is, at this point in time, no effort or very little effort made to conceal or to hide the ritual aspects of in plain sight public rituals. On one level, people have become so accustomed to it that it fails to elicit any real response. And of course, the younger generations have grown up with a popular culture saturated with symbology and occult references, and they've been immersed in it. You could make the argument we're nearing the end of the completion of the cryptocracy's generations old program for the transmutation of humanity, and at this stage, this very late stage, there's no need to hide what they're up to. And of course, we present far less resistance than previous generations might have when being confronted with all of the symbols and cult elements. We've removed God from the public square. Popular culture has become grossly debased. We've hammered traditional faith and values into the ground. And so what does this mean for the next generation or you know, future generations? Do we reach a point where demons themselves appear and it's cool to hang out with them, to date literal demons? So, you know, trying to figure out where this is going and recognizing how far we've come in what a short period of time is really disturbing and alarming.
What does this culminate into? And you have these open air spectacles during arena sports where, you know, the assembly line choreography becomes really obscene, and these women are contorting their bodies. And I don't mean to sound puritanical here, but if you take that in addition to the occult symbology and demonic references, and that's your public entertainment, people aren't figuring this out. It's really troubling.
It is, and you know, perhaps one of the most troubling things is a lack of recognition of the depths to which popular culture has fallen. You know, there's very little acknowledgement on the part of the younger generations. They just don't have the context and the background. They've been immersed in it their entire lives. They don't see or understand the impact on, you know, their lives and their psyches, and understand what is being done to them. I mean, on one level, it's about completely undermining traditional values, but then, you know, perhaps on another level, it's sex magic. It's, you know, it's designed to transform us and remake us in the image of the dark one. You know, it's not just soft porn at the halftime Super Bowl show. It, you know, this inundation with sexual content and deviant sexual practices, it has a very real and lasting effect, especially on the doses that we're subjected to it. You know, it affects those of us, you know, in the Generation X and earlier. But, you know, imagine having grown up where it is the norm. It's, you know, you never knew it to be any different. You don't recognize, you know, how far we've descended since, you know, say the 1950s. And, you know, that's not advocating for a puritanical, repressive culture that existed then, but, you know, we've gone so far in reaction to some of the excessive repression in previous generations that we now have no ability to gauge what is in fact healthy and what is, you know, should be appropriate viewing or conversational matter for mixed audiences, and especially, you know, including children and teens.
Kent, would you talk about the awakening of a populace to these things that aren't happening by chance? And could a building awareness slow down or stop the black magic psychological and physical attacks against society? This is all assuming there isn't a compliant network of secret club members infiltrating positions of government, education, and law enforcement.
Well, one would hope that by becoming aware of, you know, this occult program that we're being put through, that we would then be somehow empowered and enabled to effectively resist what is being done to us. But you could certainly take the alternative view in that all of this is part of an occult awakening that is really an engineered and alchemical transmutation of human consciousness, that we are being transformed by our exposure to all of these symbols and rituals. We should educate ourselves on these topics, but be aware of the risks and the dangers of simply focusing on these things, you know, things that we don't fully understand, ritual magic, symbology, and I'm not entirely sure that we can slow down this process or have much of an effect and effectively resist. But again, Michael Hoffman has pointed out, if we don't take action, at least on a personal level, and resist in some fashion, then we are in essence, consenting to what is being done to us and complicit in our own enslavement. To your last point, you know, I think unfortunately there is a compliant network controlling all of our institutions, a network that facilitates the cryptocracy's multifaceted agenda, and you know, their push for full spectrum dominance of humanity. I think that, you know, that paints a rather bleak picture. I think we are wise to educate ourselves and to resist in ways that don't get us killed, but I think we have to be honest with ourselves and honest about the magnitude of the all-encompassing capacity of the foe that we face. And so it's a real fine line between doing what we can to resist and making and trying to understand what's being done to us, but then not becoming so absorbed with that we can't love our lives, and that we, you know, in some instances, people that devote their lives to these kinds of things and make a lot of noise, they get squashed like bugs. So we have to walk a really fine line.
You made me think about the human psychology of the shadow, where Paul Levy, author of the book Watiko, talks about the shadow as being this device where if you ignore it, it grows bigger. Carl Jung says the same thing. And there is a similar comparison here. There's a similar mechanism at work with the cryptocracy. By giving consent, it feeds off of that and grows more powerful. On a large scale, when people realize that by giving their consent, they can reduce the fear of the cryptocracy, when they understand that is the dynamic that exists. Getting back to your book, the Twin Towers were emblematic pillars of Hermes, a memorial to the destruction of Atlantis. And you mentioned they symbolically mark the boundary of this world and the next. There are many occult aspects of the ceremonial altar where the tower stood. Would you please talk about this gateway?
The Twin Towers represented a number of things, as you pointed out, pillars of Hermes or the twin pillars of Freemasonry. And in essence, in looking at them in context and what was done in that location with those, you know, gigantic symbols on that very specific day, which we'll talk about the astrological implications in a moment, but they were, in essence, massive sacrificial altars. They were consecrated on very specific dates, dates of high importance, the time of their groundbreaking. That might be hard to digest for those that are not familiar with the concept of 9/11 as a mega ritual, but that's really just scratching the surface. There were so many other elements at Ground Zero at the World Trade Center complex. It wasn't just the Twin Towers. As I go through in the book, in a piece by piece, what you find is a massive outdoor, you know, ceremonial sacrificial complex that even includes the Statue of Liberty, representing Lucifer, overlooking the entire ritual working that day.
Yes, I do think that's difficult to grasp, because most people know of the Statue of Liberty being a symbol of freedom, a symbol of liberty. And how did you begin to see the Statue of Liberty as a symbol of Lucifer?
Well, really only once I had gotten into dissecting the broader mega ritual. That wasn't something that I had been aware of for a long time. And in doing broad research and looking at all of the other symbols, and then just began to read what others had written about what the Statue of Liberty represents. And of course, the exoteric interpretation of Statue of Liberty represents, you know, from a nationalistic general perspective, is of course freedom. But if you look at the other similar statues, you look at the iconography and the symbology involved, you look at the various, you know, references, it is clear that to the orchestrators of 9/11, this was a massive representation of the God of Light, and that you can't, you know, say it was exclusively this or exclusively that. I mean, there is also within the statue, of course, there are elements or aspects of the goddess. In looking at the script for 9/11 and, you know, how the engineers of 9/11 would have viewed the statue and what it represented to them on that particular day, you know, it played a very specific role. And it's not about, well, you know, does it mean this or that? A symbol or a piece of architecture or a statue can represent multiple things in multiple contexts. But in on this day, in this ritual, in this location, the Statue of Liberty represented the seething energies of Lucifer. And I think that if you look at various other elements and symbols involved at the World Trade Center and the environs, you get this message very clearly. You know, there are nuances, and you could argue, well, it represented this, not that, but you cannot argue that what took place that day was a global Luciferian mega ritual, and, you know, replete with human sacrifice.
Ken, you write in one of the first chapters, there were those, however, to whom these numbers and the ancient symbols represented by the Twin Towers meant much, much more. Those who were waiting, watching, applauding as the grim script for the day's events unfolded brilliantly and flawlessly. These individuals were not Muslim extremists, not motivated by hatred for the great Satan, but paradoxically by a love for Satan and himself. On the top of the surrounding World Trade Center buildings, there's an unfinished pyramid, a stepped pyramid, a square pyramid, and a dome. And for Building 7, you've also indicated the 47th problem of Euclid and the trapezoid. All of this has deep, significant meaning in a more esoteric language. That's important to incorporate into the mega ritual. Would you talk a little bit more about that?
As we talked about earlier, you know, it is not by any means just the Twin Towers as these massive twin symbols. There were literally symbols and you know, occult references all over the place at Ground Zero, including on the rooftops of some of the other World Trade buildings. There was the unfinished pyramid, the step pyramid. There was the dome, which can be viewed as a symbol of Sirius, representative of Sirius. These were not symbols that were employed haphazardly. There was a cohesive magical operation at work here, and I don't begin to fully understand it, but I think there was a very sophisticated symbolic magical operation involving these supersized symbols that was being executed, a program that was being run, a spell that was being cast on a grand scale. And, of course, not just in New York City, but in Washington, D.C. at the Pentagon, you know, Shanksville, where Flight 93 purportedly came down. So this was a mega ritual that was taking place in multiple locations during the course of the day that had been decades in the planning. And, you know, this is not even touching on all of the circumventing of the national security and defense apparatus that had to occur in order to enable these things. You know, we're one level down, or several levels down from that, but this was a logistically enormous undertaking. And most people have difficulty just with the idea that 9/11 was an inside job. It's almost a fairy tale. Unfortunately, it's extremely naive compared to what the reality is. You have to go past that. That's really, you know, one of the first levels of distraction that you have to move past in order to get to what actually took place, how long it had been in the works, the occult philosophy and rationale that underlied everything that was taking place that day. And, of course, there were practical, you know, strategic objectives that were being accomplised. I mean, 9/11 took us into three wars, you know, and we're still not out of one of them. They have a massive buildup in the domestic surveillance state and a dramatic reduction in civil liberties. But we're digging deeper. We're digging beyond all of that. And it's hard to go that far down the rabbit hole for a lot of people. And I understood that when I wrote this book. You know, I try to ease people down a little bit further and down a little bit further, because when you get to this level, you really don't want to believe that this is possible, that this is true, that there is a coordinated effort, a group of interests, not one group in particular, but a group of individuals and interests, organizations that have the ability to execute something like this. It's terrifying. And most people don't want to immerse themselves in this, you know, long enough to understand the different aspects and then to make sense of it. So it's getting back to the symbols on the rooftops and the Twin Towers, there was a gigantic magic ritual taking place that day. And if you can follow that far down the rabbit hole, you then have to entertain the question of whether or not it was successful, whether or not all of this effort that was put into these things, you know, that this was not merely for the entertainment of those that were executing this mass ritual. You have to ask yourself whether or not the spell that they were casting that day had a very real effect, whether it took effect and is perhaps in effect even to this day. You know, did they release at the Twin Towers and at the Pentagon, did they release some energies into the world in a literal way that we're still confronted with? I mean, that it was the unleashing of negative energies and potentials certainly on a militaristic level, and the assault that we waged on the Middle East in the wake of 9/11. But as you dig deeper and deeper, you have to ask yourself, did their magic spell work? And I think you can make an argument that it did.
We are seeing more of a demonic presence. If this was opening a gateway to an underworld, we certainly have evidence of more exorcisms and hauntings and things like that. Who would know if that was really part of the spell? Getting back to your book, Kent, Sirius features prominently in the 9/11 occult script. It's known as Alpha Canis Majoris, and ancient Egyptian temples were built to align with the bluish-white star. In one capacity, the Sirius is a surrogate for Anubis, representing safe passage from one realm to the next. And there was a tribute that you include in the book, a tribute to Sirius, the dog that had passed away. Here's an excerpt from that tribute. "Dazzling sparkle in the distance, brightest star on earth, closest to our heart. You came and shared your light for such a little while, brought such brightness, gave such joy. Sirius, brilliant in the night, star of the first magnitude, hero of the same, 9 light years away, held here in our hearts for eternity, run free across the rainbow bridge and in green pastures. You have done your job well, friend." Kent, would you talk about Sirius and the date of September 11th, 2001?
As we've seen in other aspects of the script for the 9/11 mega ritual, it's just replete with dark humor and inside jokes or mockery. And in this instance, the service animal named Sirius, whose badge number was 17, which is the 17th tarot, which is the star, which is Sirius, that was the orchestrator's way, wickedly humorous way, of invoking Sirius the dog star directly in this ritual, this global ritual, and being able to speak the name of the dog star openly and publicly, and it's an act of serious worship, if you will. The date of September 11th is, in fact, the start of the new year on the Egyptian Coptic calendar. So on a one-level 9/11 was a gigantic New Year celebration, and the September 11th is the traditionally observed date for the first dawn rising of Sirius. Over time, that date, first dawn rising, has moved forward over the millennia, but that's beside the point. This is the observed date as embedded in the calendar, one of the calendars of the elite, and it's a reference to, of course, Sirius, the dog star. And in the occult philosophy of the dark occult, Sirius is the abode of Lucifer, seething with the dark energies of Lucifer. Sirius is also the blazing star of the Freemasons. That's the true identity of the blazing star that is worshipped in Masonic lodges. And so you can understand then why they would employ the prop of this living animal that was the sacrifice to Sirius, represented Sirius, so that they could then bring forward in a very open manner Sirius and pay homage to Sirius, and then thus indirectly to Lucifer in context of this mass human sacrifice. And there were memorials to Sirius, the service animal, the only animal to die in service and active duty that day. And so there were memorials, there were websites, there were paintings, and it just went on and on and on. And so the gag goes on and on and on, seemingly endless. And of course, here we are talking about it many years after the fact. So it was an ingenious element, and on some level, we are in awe of what they have done in certain instances. I think we have to be careful not to be too taken with it, because that's precisely what they want, is for us to worship them and their omnipotence, or their seeming omnipotence. But it does entail an enormous amount of creativity, and we have to be careful not to be seduced by that.
Kent, you write, the untold number of times that the phrase 9/11 has been spoken or written in the past 10 years, that it has appeared in print or on screen, been uttered on the airwaves, in news reports, in documentaries, been said by countless millions in private conversation. Every time it's used, we unknowingly participate in the mega ritual, repeating evil magic over and over. That in itself was an important layer that lives on to this day, because people don't say the attacks on September 11, 2001. They say 9/11. The flight numbers of the aircraft known to be involved refer to the prime numbers of Aleister Crowley's systems of black magic, flights 11, 77, 93, and 175. Would you please give insight into how numerology was deeply layered into the events on that day?
The numbers 9 and 11 themselves have specific meanings, characters, according to occult philosophy. And again, here we're dealing with the dark occult and what they mean to the practitioners of black magic. And in the context of this massive Luciferian mega ritual, so the coded message here with 9/11, 9 is said to have an evil character, and magic is the connotation of 11, so translation of 9/11 is evil magic. On another level, of course, the universal number, emergency services number in the United States is 911, and that is not by coincidence. And that is a hard pill to swallow, but there's a very real and very powerful purpose behind that. 9/11 was the greatest trauma to our collective consciousness that has occurred in the last half century, arguably. And for the shorthand, for the phrase that we use to refer to the attacks of September 11th, 9/11, for that to be identical to our use of that of 911 as a call for help, that creates significant cognitive dissonance. And of course, that plays in, or is part of the program to keep us always in fear, constantly confused and on edge. It first sounds trivial, but once you meditate on that a little bit and think further about it, it makes tremendous sense. It creates this real confusion at a subconscious level. And all numbers, of course, are in occult thought have specific characteristics and properties within the black magic philosophy of Aleister Crowley, who is known as the godfather of modern Satanism. There are a series of numbers that we find throughout the 9/11 event that are of extreme importance within his philosophy. And on one level, he was the guest of honor throughout the day in the lead up to 9/11, but specifically on that day. And the flights, American Airlines flights 11 and 77, and United Airlines flights 93 and 175, those numbers are of just extreme importance to Aleister Crowley and in his writings and in his philosophy. And you could view those not just as references to Crowley, a way to invoke him and his legacy, but those were also, on some level, used to consecrate the sacrificial vessels, the airplanes themselves. And, we don't have to argue about, well, were they drones? Were there actually passengers on the planes? Did anybody die? We know people died on 9/11. It's sort of irrelevant that this was part of the magical working, the magical formula. It's a very clear occult statement. And invoking Crowley through the use of these numbers and then invoking what these numbers represent, which to go through and detail what each of these numbers mean or imply would take too long, during a short radio interview, but I go through those in chapters in the book and plug them into, these sub-rituals that were occurring with each of these planes, because these weren't just separate acts that, loosely connected. They were highly integrated. They each, for instance, came from a very specific direction, hit specific floor numbers in the buildings they struck. The depths of the logistics that were taken into consideration and that were executed in every aspect of 9/11 is mind-numbing. But the numerology and how that informed so many elements of the 9/11 mega ritual is really profound.
Kent, in past shows, we've gone into depth regarding natural energy lines mapped out in New York City, and this energy is known to be a neutral magnetic energy that can be used for positive life-giving reasons or for hideous occult rituals. Either way, the energy lines are here, and they're powerful enough for the cryptocracy to rely on them to help with the mega ritual. Would you please talk about some key architectural elements of the Twin Towers, Dealey Plaza, and the significance of where 2 million tons of material from Ground Zero was deposited?
So ley lines are yet another aspect of the design of this event, of this ritual, and the location, World Trade Center complex, it sits at a known intersection of several ley lines, and that takes us yet another level deeper in our consideration. And there are various methods for tapping these earth energies. And, for in this place on this date, for the purposes were intended, these energies, were tapped by the symbols and what these symbols mean. And the Twin Towers were not just symbols in themselves. They were wrapped in symbols. If you look at the design of the buildings, they were wrapped in a trident design. It is repeated on both of the towers, of course. They're being twin towers, the trident is a classic fire symbol. It is the origin of Satan's pitchfork. It has a Poseidon spear, but then we're not talking about what it means in that context. We're talking about what it meant on this day and this ceremony. And it was, of course, intended to invoke the seething energies of Lucifer, the gates of hell, to perhaps literally opened the gates of hell to receive the dead and dying. And what's interesting is that looking at the previous greatest mass ritual that occurred some 50 years earlier with the JFK assassination, the killing of the king, that I discuss at length in my second book, Daley Plaza was not only the location of the first Freemasonic lodge in Dallas. There were not only multiple very, very powerful symbols located there. The design of Daley Plaza itself is that of the Trident. And so there was this echo in history with the 9/11 events that tied back to one of the greatest traumatic collective experiences in United States history with the assassination of JFK. So there was this echo throughout time. And, of course, there are serious aspects and there's outright mockery. As the cleanup began on 9/11, the abrupt removal of materials, i.e. evidence, that was transported by dump truck and by ferry across the river to a landfill. And when I first read the name of the landfill, I thought it was a joke and I couldn't believe it. And it is a joke. It's just a joke on us. The name of the landfill is Fresh Kills Landfill. And that's where all the remains of the Twin Towers and all the human remains from the collapse of the towers were deposited after 9/11.
Well, the Millennium Hilton Hotel, located at the mega ritual altar of Ground Zero, bears uncanny resemblance to the fictional monolith in Stanley Kubrick's film 2001, A Space Odyssey. In the science fiction film, the structure stood witness to the formation of the New World. Would you talk about this connection, please?
Certainly, you can very much make the comparison that the Millennium Hotel was supersized monolith, 2001 monolith, that was standing as a sentinel, standing witness to the creation of a new world on 9/11. And it's, again, it's one of these instances where it is, on one level, a very serious component of the overall magical undertaking, representing the radiating ashlar of the adepts, of the practitioners of black magic. But then on another level, it's an obvious reference to the 2001 monolith with the apes dancing around it and beating their chests. And so, it's that wicked humor that we find. But on the more serious side, it was sitting ringside as a direct witness to this ritual working, this ritual undertaking, and broadcasting it to the dark gods, if you will. Whether figurative or literal, portal to hell was opened up that day and thousands cast into the abyss. This agent of the dark gods stood witness and bore testimony to that. And so, as I referenced earlier, there's this just absurd collection of these very potent symbols. And then beyond that, it's taking place on a very, from the occult perspective, on the most auspicious occasion on the calendar. And of course, this was not just 9/11. This was not just Happy New Year tribute to Sirius. This 2001 was the first year of the new millennium, not 2000. The actual first year of the new millennium was 2001. And so this was, in one sense, ringing in the new millennium, not just the new year. It was a millennial celebration and dedicating the new millennium to Lucifer and seeking his blessings and seeking to dedicate this new cycle of time to the dark god.
Which has a connection to your third book, Blackjack. Kent, if the towers represent the two pillars of Freemasonry, would you talk about the symbology of the current One World Trade Tower?
The Twin Towers, of course, were separate objects, and the One World Trade Center is an embodiment of architectural embodiment of the principle of as above, so below, with the intertwined upward and downward facing triangles. It is literally an occult statement and represents unification, but not in a positive sense. It's more a direct reference, you know, one world trade, the one world government, the new world order that is being brought about, and being brought about in part by the destruction of the Twin Towers, which the One World Trade Center replaces. But the date on which it was begun and finished, there are multiple aspects of the One World Trade Center that constitute a very powerful statement, and that statement speaks directly to the unification of the power and authority of the elite. It's not a unification of humanity for some grand new age in which will that freedom will flourish and blossom. This is a much darker meaning intended here with that building.
Kent, I can see your book, 9/11 as a Mass Ritual, can be very dangerous. It's a solid primer into decoding occult ritual magic used to attack a society on many levels. You include part of author Michael Tesserian's article on symbol literacy. He writes, quote, "Due to chronic symbol illiteracy, we live our lives largely unaware of a great poison in our midst, something that has a profoundly negative effect on our conscious and unconscious selves. It involves the deliberate and subversive manipulation and public purveyance of words, images, numbers, colors, rhythms, and symbols, which are subsequently directed via ubiquitous media oracles toward the limbic area of our brain." Michael Tesserian ends with how the subversive forces can be sanctioned, penalized, and even overthrown once we return to symbol literacy. If this is true, then it's profoundly predictive, considering the massive censorship imposed on users of digital media. What are your thoughts on the populace being consciously fluent with pattern recognition and symbology?
I think that Tesserian's interpretation of this is a very hopeful one, and I would hope that he was correct, but I think you could take an alternative perspective in that, of course, he's arguing that a profound symbolic literacy within the general public would help us overthrow our oppressors. I think you could make a competing argument that, first of all, the general populace has become so complacent, apathetic, and indifferent, nobody cares. You can cry fire all you want to, and they'll just sit there and burn alive. But we are knowingly, in many instances, and unknowingly with a certain segment of the population, but we are immersed 24/7 in a sea of dark occult symbols and in plain sight black magic rituals. And all the public wants to know is what the score of tonight's ball game is. But the more people are aware of the symbolism, that doesn't translate into true understanding or wisdom. Just because they might be aware to some extent or another of the symbology and the programming and the attempt to influence us through subconscious means, that doesn't mean they begin to understand the operations or what does it work and the potency of these symbols. And they're certainly not immune to them. If you toy around with black magic, you're very likely going to experience a negative outcome. And in this situation, some percentage of the population knows we're being bombarded with these symbols, they still consume them. And so the subconscious psychological effects that these symbols have on our being, on our psyches, we don't begin to understand that, or most of us don't. And you don't just look at a symbol, your mind processes it at a subconscious level, and the symbol in turn processes us. We don't know what is being done. You can view a surgical operation, but you have no idea what's really taking place and what the surgeon is doing to you. And we don't understand what operations are being performed on our psyche, the impacts, the outcomes. And so I think we have to be very careful. I would hope that Michael Sarion is correct in his optimistic outlook, but I think we have to look a level deeper and be very careful, because we're being immersed in an environment, I guess you could make an analogy to 5G. I mean, we're being immersed in this entirely new environment. Our bodies haven't evolved to adapt to. It's absolutely foreign to us. It's extremely intense. It's billions of times stronger than the electromagnetic environment that our ancestors evolved in. And we really don't understand exactly what it's doing to us. I mean, we have some horrible preliminary insights into what it could be doing to us. And I think that the analogy with, our immersion in the sea of occult symbolism and these magical operations that we just, we point at this and that and, talk about how Beyonce did this and Jay-Z's doing that. Well, we're still consuming it, and we have no idea really what effect, long-term effect, it's having on us. And so I think we have to be very cautious and very careful and very guarded.
Kent Bain, author of The World's Most Dangerous Book, 9/11 as a Mass Ritual. This is the third interview we've done recently, looking at your past three books, and it's very important to examine again. And we only scratch the surface of the content of this book. If listeners want to learn more about your work, how do they reach you?
My author page on Facebook is /SKBain. My email address is incorporated into the Facebook page. My books are available through my publisher's website, tryandday.com. They're available at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and find booksellers across the country.
Kent, thanks again for being on Another News. I really appreciate it.
It was wonderful to be with you.
There was a lot of cover-up by the Department of Defense when investigators started to look at the Saudi Arabian students training at U.S. military bases or flight schools in Florida after September 11, 2001. It's interesting because of the recent story, now 20 years later, about a federal investigation launched into 850 Saudi Arabian soldiers training in the United States. Here's part of an NPR story on this news. The Trump administration is planning to announce that more than 20 Saudi students receiving military training in the United States will be sent back to their home country, according to two U.S. officials familiar with the matter. The expulsions come in the wake of a Pentagon review of the Saudi officer who opened fire last month at a naval base in Pensacola, Florida, leaving three sailors dead and wounding eight others. Earlier reports indicated that about 12 Saudi trainees would be kicked out of the country. However, those reports didn't include Saudis who will be expelled from military bases other than Naval Air Station in Pensacola, according to the U.S. officials who spoke to NPR on condition of anonymity. Some Saudis are being expelled because they viewed child pornography, according to the officials. Other Saudi officers in the U.S. were involved in extremist online chat rooms, according to one of the officials. The shooting prompted the Pentagon to suspend operational training of all Saudi Arabian military students in the United States indefinitely as federal investigators conduct a security review of some 850 military students in the United States from Saudi Arabia. Well, it appears that people are responding appropriately to a potential threat here in the United States. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.